And now, stay tuned for another episode of the Traumatic States of America.
Welcome to the Traumatic States of America. Our main goal is to begin to heal some of the trauma we have suffered, both individually and collectively. I am your host, Dr. Lori Hood, and I will be talking with people from all walks of life who have suffered trauma in its myriad forms. Military veterans, attorneys, first responders, football players, stay-at-home moms, and many more. We will hear how trauma has not only affected them, but their families and communities, as we take an in-depth look at what science has to offer and what can be done to prevent, mitigate, and help recover from trauma. And I am here today with Mike Lewis, who is a husband, father, firefighter, paramedic, and welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So he's a firefighter paramedic from Butler County, Kansas. And I have credentials, tons of credentials here, but he's modest enough not to ask. He asked me not to just read them all out. So you kind of want to get to it, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So so we met. I just want to sort of plug the IGY 622 podcast. Because we met through that podcast. And why don't you tell me a little bit about that podcast and why it's so meaningful to you?
So the funny thing is, out of all places, Brian and I met via TikTok, out of all the social media places. and we started to talk and we kind of connected. And he's like, we need to get your story out there. And I've never really divulge that information to the public, let alone people that are close to me. A lot of people had no clue what I was going through. And he challenged me to go on his podcast, and I kind of one-upped him. And I told him, I was like, well, let's do a Facebook Live podcast.
Oh, God.
So,
wow.
So I up you. Yeah. So he was down for the challenge because he's never done that either. And we literally sat there and, you know, just discussed everything that was going on. And, you know, kind of fast forward to today, he has been detrimental to my success, you know, getting over it. Because I know for a fact that, you know, I have his personal phone. I can call him any time of the day and I know that he's going to answer.
Yeah.
And his mission and my mission are the exact same.
Okay. Tell us what's that mission? Because that's super important to who you are and why you're here.
So when I first got diagnosed, you know, I was at a loss. I was like, there's nobody here. I can't talk to anybody. And I, you know, damn sure cannot let my boss know this. And so then we started talking and we got to that point where it was like, we have to reach out and get other firefighters, paramedics, EMTs that are just like me, to be able to come out and voice their concerns and tell them, hey, yeah, I'm fighting those same demons. You know, and my thing that I kind of say is, you know, I have the demons on the playground.
Yeah.
So just to let other people like me that are so closed in and don't talk to break that shell and literally kick that door down and let everybody know, hey, I got this. I'm not doing okay today. I need some help. Whether it's just sitting in the garage or, you know, going out to, you know, my escape is to go out to the baseball fields and try to not be so closed and, you know, start to be open about it and be like, it's okay. Like, not to be okay.
Yeah, it's okay not to be okay. But it's hard. It's really hard. And just from my side of things, I know statistically and from doing research on emergency responders that if you are open, you know, generally, if you're open and you tell your boss, there's a good chance that you'll lose your job, right? Right. So there's a real reason why it's not comfortable talking to your boss or, you know, going for help or whatever. So I think that is changing. You know, I think it is changing, but I want to segue because we've talked a little bit, actually we've talked quite a bit. I want to segue to your boss because I would like to challenge all leaders out there, whether it's fire service or law enforcement or, you know, military, whoever this man is, who I've yet to meet, that I really want to meet, the way that you've described how he has led you is just phenomenal. And it's a model for how those of us who have PTSD, whether we're law enforcement or firefighter paramedics or military or just regular people like me, it's what we need. So can you give me that sort of what you talked about him and how he and still is, was there for you and still is there for you?
So my boss, Frank, he's known worldwide. He's probably the best of the best. I was sitting at the station. I was out in the bay. And, you know, if you ever get to meet me in person, I'm a kind of a social butterfly. You know, I talk to everybody. Everybody talks to me. And, you know, that's just kind of who I am.
Right.
And I was alone out in the dark in the bay, and he came up and he's like, "What's wrong?" And I was like, "Nope, you're in uniform. I'm not talking to you." And so he literally took his uniform top off and he said, "Okay, now we're friends." He's like, "Now talk to me." So I was telling him, I'm like, "There's no way I can do this." And he's like, "What are you afraid of?" And I told him, I said, "Honestly, I'm afraid to lose my job. Like, I need this job. You know, this is my passion. I love it. But on the flip side, it provides for my family. You know, it allows us to go, you know, obviously I have it's income that comes in." And he's like, "Mike, whatever you tell me, you will not get fired." He's like, "We will get you the help." He's like, "We will get you the help you need, and we will make sure that you're okay."
And then he did it. Like, it wasn't just lip service, right?
Right. He was able to talk the talk, and then he walked the walk. He proved it time and time again.
Right. And right.
So I was really nervous to go. Let me change the wording. I was really scared to go back to my therapist, because now that my boss knew, I was like, "Oh man, he knows this. I'm going to be taken out of service. I'm not going to be able to work. Like, I can't afford this. Like, this will end me." And he came up to sit, you know, to the station that I was at, and he closed the doors and he's like, "You're not going to get fired." He's like, "You're going to clock in on your next shift. You're going to do your job at the highest capability that I know you can. And we're going to support you." He's like, "Just go see your therapist."
Yeah. That's wow.
So I was like, man, and I trust this guy with everything that I have, you know, and I can talk to him literally about anything. So when he told me that, I was like, okay. Like, so I scheduled another appointment and I went. And I was like, man, I'm going to get canned. And that's all I told my therapist. I was like, I'm going to get, you know, shit canned. Like, how do I tell my wife? Like, how do I tell my kids? You know, and I go back to work the next day and I actually felt okay. Like, I had a huge smile on my chest.
Wow.
I didn't feel like I had the weight of the world on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. And he walked by me and he's like, "You went, didn't you?" You know, as you know, all that stuff is confidential.
Absolutely.
And I told him, absolutely. He's like, "I can tell." He's like, "You're going to be okay."
Yeah. So it's interesting. There's a relatively new concept out there called trauma-informed leadership. And I've written an article about it, just because trauma is kind of in my wheelhouse, right?
And, right.
But I'm thinking as you're talking, he is the example of that. So it seems to me that what he did was he first of all paid attention. He was able to recognize the signs that you were hurting deeply and struggling. And he didn't just do sort of the, "Hey, if you need me, I'm here" kind of shit, right? He just said,
yep.
You know, and he kept kind of almost pursuing you, saying, "Look, I know you're not okay. I'm here. You're safe," which is huge with trauma. "You're not going to lose your job. Go ahead, see your therapist." And then I can say that what happens with people with trauma is once we can trust someone and then they actually are trustworthy, it's huge. Like, oh my gosh, like, you actually didn't betray me, right? Because we're sort
down.
Of used to that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was that's the thing, you know. And I was extremely nervous, you know, first of all, to tell my wife that, man, I just got hit with this. you know, because she knew, and, you know, a couple other former friends of ours that, you know, I still have the utmost respect for, you know, they came over and they're like, Mike, you need to go get checked out. You need to go get help. You know, you're going down the same path as this guy, you know, which is, you know, one of my former friends. And, I was like, there's no way, because I'm not military. You know, I'm just a firefighter, paramedic. I'm a full-time paramedic and I'm a part-time firefighter. Mm-hmm. And so when I jumped on that podcast with Brian, I told him that, and he's like, you know what? And I'm like, oh God. He's like, we're just going to call a spade. And he's like, I think that's a bullshit answer. He's like, we have so many first responders out there that have that same mentality, mm-hmm. that, you know, they don't want to come out and be like, hey, I'm hurting. I'm not okay. I need some help. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and he made the perfect analogy. He's like, Mike, when I went overseas, you know, and he called it the sandbox. He's like, when I went over in the sandbox, I had one mission. We briefed over our mission. We went and performed that mission. We made that guy's worst nightmare come true. And then we debriefed. And then we came home. He's like, you go to the sandbox, or AKA the ambulance or the fire truck.
Right.
And you do that 10, 12, 15, 16 times a day.
Right.
And you're going into somebody's worst nightmare.
Yep.
You know, and you never have a clue what you're going into until those tones drop. And there's a lot of times that, you know, our dispatch could get wrong information, you know, and send us, what could be referred to as like a sick call. Well, then now it's a 3-day old baby not breathing, or it's a 102 year old, you know, grandma or grandpa that, you know, just took their final breath.
Right. Right.
You know, so we never know what we're getting into.
Yeah. And I think that's where it just, so trauma is cumulative. I just want to say that for the audience. I know you know that, unless one is able to process it or, you know, work it through in a way that's, I prefer a natural way, you know, through movement and helping your body and your brain take its time to actually process it through rather than just use medications and stuff. And we've talked about that. But that's actually what got me into this. And that's what started Responders First, one of my companies, is that, you know, and I agree. I know that you know, veterans who see combat, they see horrible things, and they do go back, and they go back. But if you look at a firefighter, and this is what's where I started kind of waking up and going, oh my gosh, right? They're mandated to also, like, natural disasters and hurricanes and floods. And I was working with, and then I did a research study on what, you know, emergency responders went through. If you're from a small town or an underfunded town, or just underfunded period as a fire service, and you are mandated to go to Hurricane Katrina, it was about that time that I started going, oh my gosh, these folks never get a break, right? You go there, you work until you drop, and you're constantly working to save other people's lives and putting your life in danger. And for the audience, these folks, and I've heard this over and over again, so I feel pretty comfortable in saying it. Often, the first thing they think before they go into a fire, go into a dangerous situation, is about their family. So they're constantly going toward danger and then thinking about the fact that, oh my God, I could leave my wife and children, or my partner and, you know, or my spouse home alone because I might not come home. And facing death on a regular basis is just kind of not normal. But then you go to the disaster or whatever you're mandated to, and you know, away from family, all that stuff, come home, and guess what? You do your job tomorrow. There's no break. And
like, so, nothing ever happened.
Right. And that's a biggie. Like, nothing, I think the sort of unconscious agreement is that nothing is supposed to, it's like nothing happened. And it's your job to make sure that it looks like nothing ever happened.
Yep. We have to be 10 foot tall and bulletproof.
Yeah. But nobody is, right?
Nobody is.
And you're a pretty tall guy, right? And you're pretty bulletproof. But you know what? And that's what I love about what you're doing, is you're really helping a lot of people, because you're a big, tall, strong, you know, guy, and super capable, and you know, really easy to put the superhero tag on you. And when you say, hey, you know, this happened to me, I'm hurting. I think what you're doing is you're really helping a lot of other people who are feeling the very same way go, God, I guess if he can do it, I can do it, right?
Yep.
And I think Brian the same way. You know, I have to go back to Brian too in the IGY 22 podcast. Yeah, just amazing. So shout out to your boss. I am a big fan, and I hope that his wisdom and his style and his way of leading really gets out there and reaches other leaders, because we're losing people. So
left and right.
Left and right. Okay, so hence the 22 and the IGY6. So explain to the audience what IG6 or IGY6 means, and then explain what the 22 means so that everybody understands what we're talking about.
So the IGY6, that's basically what it stands for, is I got your six.
Yep, and six is back, right?
The six is the back, because, you know, when law, and I'm not law enforcement, but, you know, when we go in, to a fire, or they go in on a, you know, an armed robbery or something that's hostile, you know, or even, you know, when the paramedics are going to be like, hey, I got your six, like, I'm going to watch your back. We're going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the 22, that's 22 veterans commit suicide a day. So Brian combined both of those and made this phenomenal mission to get to 21 and then to get to 20. And then one day, who knows when that day is? Hopefully it's right now, but we know that it's not. There's no more 22 a day. Right. You know, there's no more veterans, you know, committing suicide a day. Because right. 22, that's a lot.
It's a lot. And if you think about it every single day, and you know, anybody with a brain can understand that we obviously are not doing what we need to do for our vets. I mean, it's just,
yep.
And you know what? It's been 22 for a very long time. I was at a Veterans Awards dinner. It was inauguration ball in DC on the 20th of January this year, after all the craziness on January 6th and everything that went on. And they had this sort of game. It was like, if you can answer the questions correctly, somebody gets a trip to Vegas or something like that. And they asked the question, how many veterans commit suicide every day? And I jumped up and yelled, because that's kind of who I am, and I wanted to win the trip to Vegas. And I said 22, and they said, no, it's something else. And I was like, I know it's 22, because I follow that, because it's right. Not changing. It's 22, 22, 22 has been the daily average for years. And so, yeah, I mean, and I love that mentality. If we could get to 21, that's progress, right?
That is huge progress.
Yes.
You know, and if you look at it, it's only one person, but that one person could go save one more person.
Mm-hmm.
And then that one person can go save one more. So it's kind of like the domino effect.
Absolutely.
That's what it's all about, is just getting the awareness out there. Not just being, you know, and I've said it on TikTok, not just being, oh, look, I want this for the attention. No, I don't. I don't want the attention. I want that guy that's built like me, that can't talk, that will not talk, to just go shatter the ice and just cannonball into it and be like, hey, I need to talk.
Right.
You know, because it takes one stubborn guy like myself to say, hey, I got this.
Right.
But it doesn't define me. I'm not going to let it define me.
Well, you certainly haven't. I mean, and I think you're just, you have to be super inspiring to me, but you have to be super inspiring to other responders. So I just did the quick math. So, I mean, I hope I'm right, but basically 22, it's 22 per day. So 22 times 7 days in a week times 52 weeks in a year is over 800 people. I mean, I think we have to actually break that down and wrap our minds around it. It's not like, you know, 22 a year. I mean, it's 22 a day.
Yep.
That's just unconscionable. It's just unconscionable, and it's not going anywhere.
There was a recent study that I'd have to go back and look, but they were saying first responders are dropping about 12 minutes a day.
Yeah, I believe that. Well, so think about it. I mean, so if you look at what you guys are focusing on and what you're doing, we were pre-COVID and then we were COVID. So just, I'm going to ask you this question. I mean, I could do it, but just tell the audience so from pre-COVID to COVID, just list the other things that you had to do and face as an emergency responder?
So the biggest one is, like, normally, like pre-COVID, we would go into a house. We wouldn't have any other than gloves and safety glasses. You know, and that's it. We wouldn't have to do anything.
Right. Just basic universal precautions, right?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So mm-hmm. COVID hit. We kept our gloves. We kept our safety glasses. Now we have a surgical mask and an N95 and gowns. So then, you know, yes, they're trying to keep our families, you know, us and our family safe, which is perfect. But then we have to decon our truck after every single call. So we literally have to take everything out, spray it down with this chemical that was, you know, said, hey, this will stop the spread of COVID, or it'll slow it. May not stop it, but it will slow it. So now we have to go run the call. So that's going to take about an hour to 2 hours, depending. And then we have to come back, take everything out of our truck, spray it down, wipe it down, put everything back in, and then go write our ticket. So your normal hour to 2 hour call, now it's 3 to 4 hours long.
Yeah. You
know, and we were doing that, you know, 10, 12 times a day.
Right. So I have an idea. Because I'm always like looking for points of stress and understanding like what you folks really go through. Let me ask you this. As you're doing all that quote extra work that you had to do was necessary, right? Tones right. are going off, right? And you can't go out because you've got to get your truck clean first.
Absolutely. You know,
so what did that do to you? Like knowing that your job is calling and you know, I know that this is really your identity. These jobs choose you guys. How hard was that on you that, okay, tones are going off. I had to get out there and there's somebody who needs me or several people who need me and I can't go and do it.
So as any first responder, you know, paramedic, EMT, whatever level of certification they are, if they disagree with me, I think they're wrong, but that's just my personal opinion. So like if we had our truck torn apart and those tones dropped, we threw everything back in. And either I drove to the call or my partner drove to the call while the other person was in the back trying to put our truck back together.
Oh my God. Wow.
Just so we can go provide that service for the community because you know, without them, we don't get paid. You know, and they deserve the best of the best from us.
I had no idea. Wow. Wow.
So then we kind of have to switch our mindset and shut it off. And then go, you know, get ready for that call.
Right.
You know, and just throw that last call on the shelf.
So literally, you disinfected stuff, you put it back in, and somebody was in the back trying to get everything together to make sure that you could do your call and take care of the public.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of time, you know, COVID put a lot of stress on, you know, I can't speak for other services, but it kind of put a lot of stress on our service, you know, because we are a small service and we were, you know, starting to get busy. We're getting busier now, you know, and you could tell that the tensions were starting to rise and everything. And we had a guy that headed up our peer support that he did a phenomenal job, you know, and he would send out a text message. Hey, I just want you guys to know that you guys are doing a great job. We're here for you. Take a break, you know, and then we started to implement it's been called a few things, you know, we need to take a time out or we need to tap out or, you know, but tap out's the wrong word for us.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, we need to take a break.
Yeah.
You know, we're not fit to run another call. So they allowed us to literally go out of service for like a 2 hour nap, you know, and just to try to get our mind right. But honestly, you know, paramedics are geared completely different. I mean, we're a different breed.
Yeah.
You know, that person needs me. I don't care if I'm tired. I don't care if I'm hungry. I don't care if I haven't ate all day. That person needs me, so I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's kind of just how we're built. You know, and like you said, this job called me. You know, and we can dive into how I got into it and all that. But you know, it's a true calling. You know, our public's, you know, our people out there, they need us, and they need us now. You know, at the drop of a hat, we go without question.
Yeah, you know, that's the other thing that, and I've talked about this a couple times on another podcast with fire chiefs and stuff, is that, you know, when we, and I'm talking about we as public, you know, citizens, we don't know who to call. We call the fire department because they've got, yep, they got firefighters and paramedics. And if there's just something, you know, I don't know, it could be the most obscure thing in the world, but it's kind of on you guys to just figure it out and help us. And it, and that has, right, to be incredibly stressful. And, you know, certainly you don't get the pay that you do or that you deserve. I also, you know, I know there's been a lot of talk about defunding the police, and I understand that sentiment. And I do believe there needs to be some, something that has to happen. But I do know also that fire service personnel and paramedics, ambulance, you know, that at least that as far back as maybe, I don't know, 8 months, a year ago, I was hearing about how rigs were being attacked and blocked and bricks. And, you know, it just feels like it, from what I've understood from, you know, working with first responders and studying them, is that you guys put your family aside, put your life on the line, and go out and save us, help us. And I'm one who was saved. That's why I got into wanting to help first responders, is I had three sheriff's deputies show up the night I called because my ex-husband had us like locked in a room, and they saved us. They saved myself and my children. And right, so the thing that I always think about, and yes, I think there needs to be a discussion. I think we need to have a meeting of the minds at some point in some way, and I hope that happens. But really, like, if I dialed 911 and there was nobody answered, like, that would not be okay with me. And that doesn't seem like a viable, reasonable alternative, because,
right,
I mean, we are so used to, in this country, we dial 911, somebody picks up and somebody comes. They, you know, there are people I know like, well, you took 20 minutes to get here. Well, I'm sorry. You know, there was somebody I was working with, or there was I know the roads get blocked if there's a bigger incident. There's just all kinds of reasons. But the, right, reality of it is somebody comes.
If somebody didn't come, we would
not know what to do as citizens, I believe.
You know, and Brian and I have had that conversation numerous times. He's like, Mike, you guys are getting attacked left and right. Thankfully, it has not happened here where I live and work, knock on wood. But he's like, what happens one day when you guys just say, you know, piss on this, I'm not doing this anymore.
Exactly.
And all of us leave.
Yeah.
You know, and then what? What are you going to do when your house is on fire? You know, or somebody's trapped in a house that, you know, is being held by gunpoint and nobody comes.
Yep, nobody comes. Yeah, and I don't think people think that far ahead. And there's lots of reasons. I mean, I there are lots of reasons for that. But I mean, if you could break it down, so the way I see it, and I'm not the end all be all, and I've never been an emergency responder. I've never been a veteran. I'm not a veteran. I'm not a military person at all. Just someone who has had interactions and worked with folks that are in those disciplines. But,
you know, and it's been my goal for every call that I go on, regardless of the type of call that it is, to make a positive influence on that patient and that family, not just for myself or my partner, but to bring a sense of calmness to that patient. You know, right, whether it's a stub toe or it's a full-blown cardiac arrest call, I've got to bring some calmness to the chaos. You know, right, and that's what we do, you know, and also provide a positive interaction so that when they, you know, heal from their injuries or their sickness or whatever, they can go and be like, I felt perfectly safe because we had this guy.
Right.
You know, right. So I take huge pride in that.
Yeah. 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 And you know, I think from what I see from your side is that you do that despite the fact that you're leaving your family behind. You might not come home. You're running to danger rather than running, you know, away from it like everybody else is. And then you're having to hold everything together enough to not only help the people and leave them with a positive experience, but also bring to bear all the training and expertise that you have. And as a, you know, knowing about neuroscience, that's a feat, because I was on one or two podcasts have I said with emergency responders that you have to be like a social genius, because you have to at once be sort of in charge, make everybody feel like you know what's going on. You know what's going on. You're going to take care of them. Everybody's safe because I'm here, which is part of the job, right?
Yep.
And access all this very technical information, so many CCs and this and that, and, you know, lines and the equipment. Oh my God. Like I went to a fire station about 3 years ago, and I got to do the whole like truck tour and all the different vehicles and all the gauges. And oh my gosh, it's like an airplane. I mean, it's gadgets and,
right.
And so have all that information. And then, you know, do all that and then turn around and see a little kid who's just shattered and be like a social worker. Like, hey, buddy, you know, it's okay. That to move from one of those to the others, that's why I started this thing called high stakes performance, because you have to be able to be in charge of your body and your mind enough to switch those gears. And those are like opposite extreme gears. Like, okay, I'm in control. I got it. I know all this stuff, you know, frontal lobes, analytical, logical, to heartfelt, you know, you're okay, honey, you're all right. You know,
yep.
It's, I don't even know how you do it. And then
within split seconds
and back and forth. Right. And then also trying to keep PTSD symptoms under control, right? Likely, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah. Just kind of an impossible job. And then doing it over and over and over again.
With a smile on our face.
Right. Do you follow Jason Patton?
I have not yet.
Oh my gosh. So I had him on the podcast, and I had him on, we did like a double episode because he is so funny. And I've followed him for, I don't know, years. So I did this one episode with him on dark humor and the psychological benefits of dark humor, because, you know, yeah, it can get you in trouble, and you don't want people to hear it if they're, you know, I mean, it's a dicey thing, but psychologically it's a coping mechanism. And so what he's doing for the community, I think, is really important. And he helps, you know, he helps bring some levity to the sort of the responder side of it. And no, it's not a funny subject. It's not funny. Nobody's making fun of anybody, but the ability to, you know, understand that our minds want to sort of release some of that tension, because like we were just talking about how, you know, you have to go, you have to do this, you have to do that, you know, fight PTSD symptoms and do it with a smile on your face. But this, so dark humor kind of helps you break some of that, and it's natural. And no, you can't do it in front of people, but anyway, it is a kind of a natural thing. And yeah, I had a fire chief on who was talking about how now one more thing that you folks have to deal with is that people often have cameras in the house. So if you make a comment to your buddy that may just be like an unconscious way to deal with the pressure, and it's recorded, then so it's one more thing to be sort of on top of. And I'm not saying that it's okay to, and I'm not talking about making jokes about people's pain. That's not what's happening. It's really like, you know, I can't do this anymore. Like, this is just too much. Or it's a way to kind of break the tension.
And I've told my wife numerous times that technology has turned us into robots on the paramedic side of things in the EMS world. It's turned us into robots where we have to come in and we have to, you know, do our job and be expressionless.
Yeah.
You know,
wow. Are you just saying that the cameras catch your expression and you could be misread?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh my gosh.
If we're on a car wreck on the turnpike, you know, we call it turnpike here in Kansas.
My
wife's in Southern California. It's called an interstate.
Right.
Or a freeway.
It's
turnpikes. You know, if we're on the highway, you know, and we have our vest on wrong, or we have, you know, we don't have our lights on, or, you know, whatever the case might be, you know, it's nothing for my boss to get a text or a phone call like, oh, hey, this one tall guy, I can be picked out of a crowd because all of my tattoos.
Lucky you.
Right. Like, oh, hey, that tattooed guy didn't have his vest on, or that tattooed guy had his hat on backwards, or that tattooed guy, you know, he had a big smile on his face when there was just tragedy everywhere. You know, so we kind of have to watch what we're doing.
Yeah, you know, of course. Yeah.
And be mindful of it. And, you know, 95% of the time we do that. But to kind of go back onto your thing, like where we use that dark humor, we have the saying, if the table at station one can talk.
Right.
You know, just the conversations that we've had over breakfast and dinner.
Right.
You know, because when we go to station one, it's there in El Dorado. Everybody can look up Butler County EMS and know where I'm talking about. You know, we have two crews. We have a Medic 10 and a Medic 11 crew. So when I'm up there, I try to eat as a crew, you know, as a family, get as much family interaction as we can, because we're gone from our families for 24 hours a day.
Right.
You know, so I leave my house at about 7:10 in the morning to get to the station, to get there early. And I won't get back home until like 9:30, unless we get a late call. Then it could be like noon or one.
Right.
So we're away from our families a lot. You know, and then to piggyback on that, I'm also a volunteer fireman for my town. I couldn't tell you the amount of dinners that I've had to like get up and just leave, or the family functions that I've had to leave, you know, just to go fight more fire, or, right, you know, go, you know, check electrical lines down, or, you know, do whatever the call is. I don't know what call it is.
Because you're fire, yeah. Firefighter, right?
Right.
You guys get all the stuff that nobody else is handling right now.
Yep. You know, and there's been, I couldn't even count how many times that, you know, I've had to roll out of bed, you know, and wipe the sleep out of my eyes at 1 or 2 in the morning and go to a car wreck.
Yeah.
You know, and, yeah, you know, go cut somebody out of a car, or, you know, go help the dive team get all their stuff ready and go dive, you know, for a recovery.
Wow. So that's your volunteer job.
Yep.
Yeah. So that brings me to something else is about spouses and partners. And that's something like I've done a lot of, you know, coaching around and work around, is that, you know, that, you know, first responder marriages and relationships end in a divorce and at a much higher rate than the average, which I think the average is still like 51% or 52%, right? So it's super high. And I remember talking to this guy, I don't know if it was on my podcast or another podcast, or if I was just, you know, was just a client, but I came to this epiphany, and it's really important, especially with fire service. So our brains are deeply hardwired to, you know, because we, a long, long time ago, we lived in small groups, clans, tribes, but small groups of people to survive, right? And we lived in, you know, like we lived together, ate together, sleep together. And importantly, we fought off danger together. That's how we could individually survive. And that's how human beings have survived as a species, right? And so what I hear from either spouses, or even the service person themselves, is that the service person goes back to the station, right? So there's a really bad call, and it's that person's day off, and they're supposed to go home for a couple of days, right? But they go home and they can't stay home. They have to go back to their folks, their people who understand them, who were there with them, and that's what they're like. What they need to do. And of course, the spouse is devastated because you've been gone for 3 days or 4 days or two, whatever it's been, right? And now you want to go back. You don't like, I've been here, and from their part, their side, I'm here taking care of everything because you're not even around. You're just gone, and so I take care of the kids and the grocery shopping and whatever, right? And then you go back. But what I would like for, you know, responders to understand, as well as spouses, is that is like a drive, right? Because and there's a bonding that happens with people who, so we've studied this in you know, veterans as well as some fire services, that's the Peace Corps too, that's that bonding that you go back to because they truly understand you and you've been through it together. And it's the way your brain wants to work through it. And it's like really natural, but it really tears people apart. And I'm hoping to help spouses and partners understand that it's not about you. It's not about the marriage. And then if the folks who are the, you know, the service folks could talk to their spouses and start to have this dialogue about, look, this is what I need. And then the spouse could say, well, this is what I need. And then maybe, you know, the spouse says, okay, can you go back just for an hour and then come back to me? And it's always, there's a breakdown in communication too, because, you know, veterans and first responders who've seen really horrible things, and they kind of all have, don't want to burden their spouses and partners with this stuff, or the spouse or partner goes like, I don't want to hear it. Like, I don't want to hear that shit. Like, that's why I don't do your job. Right. So there's this
absolute
and sort of necessary disconnect. And then, so my thing is, how do we go in ahead of it and prevent that so that,
right. My wife said it's perfect. Yeah. You know, she's like, I'm a single mom 6 months out of the year.
Yeah.
And then I pick up shifts. So I go work more. And I told her, and it was actually, you know, it's kind of funny that you brought that up. You know, Wednesday when I came home, you know, I picked up an extra shift. Just because I'm looking at the paycheck, you know, partly, but in the back part of my mind, I feel safe and I feel comfortable at home or at work. You know, my home life is not bad. But I don't have to worry about the kids screaming. I don't have to worry about feeding my kids, or, you know, I don't have to do the dishes at, you know, as often at work. I'm in my wheelhouse at work.
Right. You know,
and then I come and I deal with enough chaos at work. And I love my kids. Don't get me wrong. I would do anything on this earth for my kids. Mm-hmm. But like when I come home, it's just 200 miles an hour and I can't just like jump from paramedic to dad mode.
Right.
You know, it's a husband mode. It's like, give me just a second. I just got home. Like, let me figure this out.
Right.
You know, but like 4 or 5 years ago, that wasn't an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now
it is.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And just from her point of view, if I may, she's had 4 or 5 years with little kids, which is really hard, really hard. And so, you know, I see both sides, and I get that, you know, communication is kind of the big deal. And yeah, of course you need to transition from whatever you just experienced into, you know, a little bit of a transition kind of whoa period, just kind of come down and then you can engage. But from her perspective, she's just been on, you know, it's funny because I used to, talk about being on call. So I was married to an emergency room doctor, and he didn't have call. But my mom said at one point in time, I think my kids were like, you know, 3 and 7 or something like that. And I was like, I just, like, it's just hard. They're always like, they've got more energy and they've got more time, and I'm trying to get a PhD and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, honey, you're on call 24/7. And I said, well, no, I mean, I sleep. And she goes, no, part of your brain is engaged and listening for those kids even when you're sleeping. And it was like, bam, right? So I can only think that part of your brain and part of your awareness is still sort of waiting or on call, if you will, for that call. But then so is hers, right? So it almost feels like you guys are set up for an impossible situation because there's no win. But
I have the mindset of nothing is impossible. You know, so when I hear somebody tell us that's impossible, bullshit. Sit back and watch this. You know, we're going to make it possible.
You that's know, right. You're the watch this guy, right? We talked about that, didn't
absolutely.
We? Watch me or watch this. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Doubt me. You know, we're going to get through it. We're going to make that impossible possible. And you're going to sit back and be like, holy shit, he did it.
So that goes back to your boss, right? Can you tell me the rest of that? Tell me, please. Yeah.
Yeah. So he looked at me. He's like, what are you scared of? I'm scared of letting everybody know that I have this, first of all. I was like, this is huge. I don't want people to look at me differently. And when he looked at me and we were at the station, and he's like, you won't do it. And I, goddamn truth, I looked at him. I said,
brilliant.
Bullshit. And he's like, go prove me wrong. So that's the very next day. I made an appointment with my therapist, and he's like, what made you come in? I was like, honestly, my boss told me I wouldn't.
So obviously that's a guy who understands the personality and of a responder and a military folk, because and I think that's why PTSD just didn't work for you guys. Like, post-traumatic stress disorder, and I've heard it over and over again, tell me I'm disordered, you know, you're going to lose me. tell me I'm injured. Oh, I'm going to overcome that.
Yeah, I'm going to overcome that illness or that injury.
Yeah, yeah. Give me something to overcome and I'm right there with you. But just like,
Don't pin me in the corner.
Right. Label me disordered and like, what can I do with that? I'm screwed up, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that's just so wrong. And it really is wrong. I mean, even scientifically, it's wrong. It's, we understand now through brain imaging that it can be an injury. And it's just, and we don't treat it the same. That's why I started that hashtag stop fixing trauma. Because if you break your arm and you go to the doctor and you are both he's going to set it or she's going to set it. And then you're both going to understand that it's going to heal one way or the other, right?
Yep.
Somehow we researchers and clinicians have kind of just agreed unconsciously or whatever that the idea is to get those of us who have trauma back to the person we were. And you're not going to. We will likely get better if you challenge us. When you talk to us about post-traumatic growth theory, we'll get better. But just like label us and say we're disordered, not really, you know?
Yep. You know, and that was the biggest thing. So it was December 17th of 2020 when I got my official diagnosis. And, you know, my therapist was like, whoa, dude, you're in the red. Like, we need to figure this out because we have to save you. And I heard that. And I was like, well, shit, I'm in the red. Like, there's no saving me. Like,
wow.
Just write me off. I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. You know, and I didn't officially receive that challenge, you know, from my boss because I just got it. And I was like, oh, man. Like, how am I going to do this? Like, yeah. And I have to do it alone. I can't tell anybody.
I was just thinking alone. That's that alone thing again, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, and so the biggest thing like we were talking about is, you know, how to get from that deepest, darkest hole and get out of it alone. Well, there's not a snowball's chance in hell that you can do it alone.
Yeah.
So I started that, and that's when I found Brian. You know, and I started surrounding myself with like-minded people. They're going to challenge me on a daily basis. And if I do fall in that hole, I can guarantee it somebody's going to jump in there with me. And they're going to sit. We're going to, you know, and that's kind of my mantra as well. We're going to sit in that hole until you're ready to get out.
Yeah.
And I'm going to push you out first because I've already gotten out because I did the same exact thing.
Yeah.
And then once you get out, then I'll get out.
Does it kind of feel to you? I mean, it kind of feels to me just because I'm connected with you and Brian, and you know, I'm hoping your boss will be part of this too. But that there are enough like little groups of people that are starting to pull together and support each other. And I have several, and I'm sure you have several. But I know sometimes we talk about it as islands of safety. Like you start with one person. So you sort of started with your boss, right? Like he got it. He understood. He knew it. He was not going to give up on you. He also knew you and you know, his folks well enough to challenge you to get better, right? To go to your therapist. But that was the first step. And then you have sort of, he is your sort of first little dot of safety. But then you found Brian. And then you found some other people, I'm sure. And then it kind of comes this little small group of safe people that you can trust, right? And
absolutely.
And then you create another one, you know, with another group of people. And then those islands can connect and you start to build safety underneath your feet for the, you know, a larger space. And I think it's really important for people to know that. For those of us who have PTSI, be really careful about who you trust, first of all. Can you really trust them, right?
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah?
You know, and that was the biggest thing. You know, and kind of my island started with Brian. You know, and he brought his tribe, you know, onto my little, for lack of better words, and I don't know if I can say this, but I'm going to, for my fucked up island.
Right.
He brought his tribe, and he changed the whole mentality. You know, Brian and Scott and Alex and Dan, you know, there's a bunch of great dudes out there. That literally, man, he was like, just change your mind. him, and I'm like, well, what the hell do you think I'm trying to do? Like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go through this shit. Like, I'm done. And he, you know, all of them were like, well, you're not quitting. We're not going to allow you to quit.
Yep.
Brian's like, it's 15 hours and 7 minutes from my front door to your front door. Right. He's like, I will be there.
Yep.
And he showed me a screenshot of my house on his phone. And I'm like,
holy
shit, he ain't messing around.
No, he's
not. So I knew, I was like, okay, I'm good right here. And so once I knew that, I was like, okay. And then I, you know, I did that Facebook podcast, and then my boss, he jumped on the island, you know, and then it slowly, like you said, we slowly started to build this. I don't want to call it a community, and I don't want to call it a safety blanket, but, you know, it's a bunch of warriors that, like, okay, we got this PTS, you know, PTSI, whatever you want to call it.
Yep.
It's not going to define this group.
Right.
Because we are a bunch of badass warriors that's going to conquer it. Not necessarily, you know, get over it or get, you know, but we're definitely not going to let it knock us down.
Yep. We're not going to quit. Not going to quit.
No.
Yeah.
You know, and there's days that, you know, you just want to quit, you know, and I have a tattoo on the back of my forearm that was literally the day that I did try to quit. You know, and I went out to, you know, and I'm not trying to get too deep or anything, but I went out to, I just left work, and all I could picture was my mom. And then we can dive into that if you want.
It's up to you, whatever you're comfortable with and whatever you think. I mean, I know you and I talked about this. Both of us agreed that the whole idea behind this conversation is that we want to help people who don't have the support that we have yet, and they can get it.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. So
yes,
up to you.
Yes is the big key. So you'll hear it all. It's kind of an uncut version of Mike. But, so I went out to I left shift, and it was right after Christmas, and my mom loved Christmas time. And I have a guardian angel on my visor of my truck, and it's holding my picture of her and I dancing for the mother son dance at our wedding.
Oh my gosh. Oh.
And I just, it, for whatever reason, it just hit me with a ton of bricks. And I called like four or five people, and it was the four or five people that didn't answer their phone.
Wow.
And I was like, well, fuck this. I'm done. So I drove out to the pond, and I put my truck in park. I wrote a note, and I pulled the trigger, and it didn't go off.
Oh my God.
And I rolled my window down, pointed my gun outside the window, and it fired. And
yeah,
after the gun fired, my picture fell down. And that picture has not fallen down since 2013.
Yeah.
I was like, why the hell did this fall down? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason. Mm-hmm. What that reason is, I have no clue. But there's a bigger, better reason why I'm here. And now I've kind of slowly started to find that. And to help people, necessarily, you know, more specifically, first responders that are going through the same shit that I do, where they feel like they have nothing or nobody in their corner. And the whole time I did, you know, I didn't have the guts to reach out and, you know, tell people.
Can I say this though? I don't think it's a lack of guts, because I've worked with a lot of people and I've been through it myself. I believe that what we experience is that when we reach out often, nobody reaches back, or
right,
they don't understand, because they can't, they don't have, you know, post-traumatic symptoms. And so we learn that the best course of action is to not reach out, because it's too painful to reach out and have nobody reach back.
Well, it goes along the same thing when somebody asks you, you know, hey, Mike, how are you? Our response is, I'm okay, or I'm fine. Because nobody really, really knows how to react. And I'm going to say react when we say, I'm in trouble, I need help.
Yeah.
You know, so we're kind of geared when the demons are on the playground, we say, I'm okay, or I'm fine.
So,
because we don't want to be that burden. We don't want to overbear some, like, just blow somebody away by all of our problems when they have no clue what we're going through.
Right. And that's why I think this critical mass, like, you know, the communities that are forming, and especially the one with you and Brian and your boss, and because those communities can come out and show people that it's okay to say, I'm not fine, right?
Right.
But also, I would just want to say for the audience mostly that there's a reason why people just say, I'm fine. Because it's not okay for you not to say, I'm fine, because you're supposed to be the big, strong hero again. And so a lot of it's cultural. I mean, a lot of it's cultural. If you go back to the Leatherheads and you know, old timey firefighters, my gosh, right?
And oh, absolutely.
I think most people don't understand it was kind of from where it came, right? But it came from these men who were just crazy, right? Just going into fire.
They were the American badass.
Right. And so, and I also, my brother was a fighter pilot. He went to the Air Force Academy, and then he was a fighter pilot after that, and then an instructor pilot. And he told me one time I don't know what it was. I think I was dating a fighter pilot, and I was like, you know, he's so arrogant. He's this, he's that, blah, blah, blah. And he thinks he knows everything. And he said, you know what, Lori? And I said, what? He goes, when you're flying a jet at that speed, you cannot second guess yourself. You have to absolutely know that you're calculating correctly, that you're right, or you make a mistake and your wing clips somebody else's. And that sort of set me back. And I think it's kind of a similar thing, right? That you have to kind of know. Otherwise, I think it's so counterintuitive to make the decisions that you guys make. You have to override your human instinct. Like, humans don't, train a horse to run toward fire, right? Everything that horse is going to say, yeah, no, I'm going to run away from the fire, right? But
it's not natural.
It's totally unnatural. I was talking about this with somebody else. It's like, when you run toward a fire, and I've talked to enough folks that, like, on the way, you know, the best thing that can happen in your day is to get a good call, right? Where you can go in, you can do your work, you can make sure people are safe, you can, you know, clear the scene, you can do your job, right? And then
we can show how truly good we are.
Yeah.
You know, we can show off our skills, and it's at a drop of a hat.
Yep. Yeah. But then what I say to you folks is, you're running toward craziness and danger and possible death all the time. And your brain is going like, no. So this is a theory on my part. I have no science to back it up, but my guess is it probably happens when you are overriding your hardwired instinct to run from danger and making your physical body and your mind and everything else run toward danger. The stress upon your system has to be absolutely off the charts, because you're making yourself do something that everything that we have evolved to be is saying, no, do the opposite. And there has to be like just tons of, you know, adrenal secretions and cortisol and norepinephrine, and everything is hitting your system. First of all, because it's an emergency. And second of all, because it's going like, run the other way, like get the fuck out of here. Right.
Right.
And so you force yourselves, because it's your job and because it's who you are, to do this stuff. But I think the toll that it takes on your physical body is extreme. And so just those, you said that for a while during COVID, you guys got like a 2-hour break to go like take a nap.
We tried.
That's barely scratching the surface. Really, what I think first responders need is they need a break with like some silence or some, I would hope that someday you guys could do mindfulness. And I know in some departments they are, but even some sensory deprivation stuff, because the brain and nervous system has to sort of come back down and actually feel safe. Well, that's that self-debrief I was talking to you about that we talked about.
And I think that would be one of those that we would literally change the entire EMS world with that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. And I'm hoping that nobody I've spoken to has kind of stolen the idea and gone forward with it, but it's mine and I have, you know, and I have it. But so that's something I really want to do. And for the audience, what Brian and I have talked about is something that I created. It's called a self debrief. And I created it about 5 or 6 years ago. And basically it is something that it's a series of tasks and thinking tasks that someone can go through. The pilot showed that within about, 32 to 35 seconds, the average heart rate, so we just had a gross measurement, but the average heart rate came down 11 and a half beats. And so the idea was that it was kind of based on fire service personnel, but that firefighters could go to a fire, do their job, you know, run against danger, have all that stress, you know, save people, all the adrenaline and all the cortisol and all the neuropeptides that dump into their system to have them do their job, come back, scene is cleared, everything's good. They either are by the truck or they get in the truck. They could literally pull up an app with this, or I've had people just go through storyboards so far, do these 4 or 5 simple things, and their physiology comes back down into what we call the window of tolerance. And it will absolutely either prevent or mitigate PTS symptoms. And so we're like Brian and I are talking about this because we're right there. Like we're right there to sort of putting it out and getting it in the hands of you know, first responders. And if we could put it in the hands of military folks too, or just everyday citizens. So that's what he's kind of talking about. We're kind of putting our, I'm kind of putting my stamp on this here. That it's,
right.
Yeah. But I do. I think it could really help. I mean, I know it could help because my private clients have access to it and they go just, some of them are just like CEOs of Fortune 100 companies and they're under their own kind of stress, different kind of stress. But they use it and they absolutely feel the benefit from it. And, so yeah.
No, and I kind of, when I heard about that idea on Brian's podcast, I was outside fixing the mow when I listened to your podcast, and I've never had a strange woman make me do jumping jacks in my front yard, and I did it.
Jumping jacks are your friend. I'm just trying to right? get that said. Jumping jacks are your friend, so that everybody just has it drop into their mind and they do jumping jacks, right? Yeah. Don't tell you did jumping jacks.
Yeah, so I looked silly as shit doing jumping jacks in my front yard trying to mow. But after I did like 20 of them, I'm like, okay, well, that's no longer on my mind.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, of what was kind of triggered in that podcast, you know, because there's a bunch of triggering stuff in there. And when I was listening to it, I was, you know, home with my kids and I was mowing. And when you were like, just go do jumping jacks. No, hell no.
Not me.
Like, well, let's try it. And it worked. I'm like, holy shit. So I went and I told our training department and I was talking about that app and all that. And, you know, that's when I reached out.
Yeah.
I was like, we could change the world. We have the same kind of goals or the mission. Our mission is the same.
Yeah.
And when he was like, let's reach out. Let's see what we can't do. Let's try to get this, you know, and get this at Butler County. So we can kind of steamroll the process, for lack of better words.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah. And
let's do it.
I'm them there. I mean, I'm absolutely. And I feel like once one department does it, it can become, because we'll learn too, right? And get
right.
feedback. I mean, the second or third pilot, it'll be the second or third pilot by the time I work with you folks, but that what works, like I know what works in a neurological kind of, you know, I can guess and work it up and do the pilots, and I can say from what I understand in sort of laboratory conditions, it works, right? But
right.
Does it work for all folks? Does it work for some folks? Does it work only for fire service? Does it work for EMS as well? Does it work for LEOs? I mean, I my guess is yes, but you know, everybody's different in personality. Everybody's got different levels of trauma. But yeah, I also, you know, the reason why I really wanted to do it, first of all, I was using it on myself, right? So it helped me. But then you know, rather than go to, and I'm not saying chaplains are bad. I'm not saying, in fact, I'm actually training to be a chaplain. But there's something that I believe is really important about those of us who have had trauma. We need to be in control of our lives. We need to have confidentiality. You know, if we've had trauma, sort of by definition, something has been taken out of our control and we have felt helpless, right? So
the
more that we can have full control over our lives, and that would be what that would do is, you know, a person could have that in their hand, and as soon as they felt ready, they could work through it, and it's just for them. And then that gives us tools, right? I mean, like you've gathered a lot of tools. The more tools we have, the better we can manage our own sin, because nobody's going to do it for us, because nobody gets it. They don't get it, and they don't want to do it for us because it sucks, right?
And nobody knows, you know, how many people actually have it that haven't told anybody.
Fair. That's fair. Or don't even know what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and so it gets misdiagnosed.
You dig out your phone and you're like, oh, I feel much better after that. You know, because whatever person A's call is, whether it be a stroke or a rollover accident, you know, because my pager just went off and they're going to a rollover accident right now. You know, so it's that could bother them where it doesn't bother me.
Right.
You know, and backward, you know, back and forth. You know, because like you said, it's all subjective.
Right.
Your trauma is different than my trauma.
Right.
But it's still trauma and it still scarred us.
Absolutely. It's still an injury. That's one of the reasons why I went ahead with this. For a long time, I felt like, okay, I was never a first responder. Like, I can't do this. And I came up with this whole model where I was going to train former first responders and former combat vets to then train current first responders. Because I think it's true. I don't have the credibility that somebody else has, but who has been a first responder. But there's also something to helping people understand that you don't have to be in a war to have PTSI, right? You know, and everybody's different. Some people have had other trauma in their childhood and they're more susceptible, or, you know, and we don't have all that as researchers. We don't have all that figured out. We don't have a formula to go, okay, so you experienced this, this, and this at 9, 13, and 15, and you're female and you're from this part of the country. And so if you experience that, you're going to have PTSD to this level, right? It doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't.
And thanks to Mike Lewis for joining me in what has become one of a two-part episode. We just went way long, so it turned out to be about 2 hours. But thank you, Michael. And I applaud you for telling your story and putting yourself out there against what is still a lot of stigma.
Thank you for listening to the Traumatic States of America. If you would like to learn more about Dr. Lori Hood, go to LoriHoodPhD.com. The Traumatic States of America podcast is produced and engineered by Bernd Ahle Productions at their studio in Washington, D.C.